I am thrilled here on the Broadway Radio Show to welcome to the show, to this episode, a librettist, composer, and lyricist who I've been wanting to get on the show, but I'm fortunate he's here with us on this week's show. He's a winner of the Ed Klabon Award, a Fred Ebb Award, a Richard Rogers Award, a Frederick Lowe Award, the ASCAP Harold Adamson Award, as well as many other awards. He's also had commissions from prestigious theater companies like The Roundabout, Playwrights Horizons, The Signature Theater, South Coast Rep, to name just a few. Welcome to Adam Guan. Hi, Adam.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited you were here. And Adam's musicals, if you are not familiar with Adam's work, but his musicals include things like Scotland PA, Ordinary Days, String, Old Jews Telling Jokes, and his most recent musical, which is the one we're going to chat about, called All the World's a Stage, which earned a Dramatic Desk nominations for Best Lyrics and Orchestrations, and also won Best Musical at the Off-Broadway Alliance Awards. It played at the Keene Company. Is that called what it's called?
Keene Company.
Last year in 2025, in spring of last year. And it has a brand new cast recording out right now from Joy Machine Records. It just came out this past Friday on February 20th. It's a wonderful cast recording. I have listened to it from beginning to end, and it's terrific. So welcome to the show. Adam wrote book, music, and lyrics. He's a jack of all trade for this particular show. So first off, before we jump into All the World's a Stage, give the listeners who are not familiar with you a little bit of background about where you grew up and your education and what ultimately led you into becoming a writer and composer.
Yeah, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, where my parents and my sister still live, so I get down there very often. But I was a piano kid, really. I from when I was very, very young, was just drawn to pianos. And I would go up to any piano I could find and sound out songs that I heard on the radio. And my parents didn't quite know what to do with me because no one else in my family has any kind of creative bent to them. But it just so happened that in Baltimore, my neighbor growing up was the organist for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. And so my parents said, hey, we have this weird kid who likes pianos. Let's give him piano lessons with our neighbor. So I was taking piano lessons, classical piano, with my neighbor who played in the symphony. And then eventually got bitten by the theater bug, at first as a performer, through a happenstance of good timing. When I was about to go into high school, the Baltimore public school system opened a magnet school focusing on the arts. And I said, oh, this is interesting. And auditioned to be part of the theater program at this high school. And so I was studying theater at this high school during the day, taking my classical piano lessons at night, wound up falling in love with theater and going to college for it. I went to NYU's Tisch School of the Arts in their drama program and had a teacher there my freshman year who was teaching performance at NYU, but outside of school was a composer, a wonderful guy named David Buchnam. And he heard me play the piano one day and pulled me aside and said, was that you playing the piano in the other room? And I said, yeah. And he said, I feel like I heard more of your voice and know more about who you are as a person hearing you play piano than I do watching you sing songs in my class. So you should go see what that's about. And, you know, as a 17-year-old, it was very jarring because I had I'd sort of made this big mental commitment to being a performer. And here's this person telling me that I should go do something else. But he was right. And by the time I graduated from college, had sort of dipped my toes into this writing thing and realized, oh, yes, this is how I express myself the best in this world. And so just sort of kept doing it from there. I had a really my first show, one of the ones you mentioned in the intro, this show called Ordinary Days was my first show to be professionally produced, sort of my big break, as it were. And I happened into a writing workshop with Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty when I was first starting to write songs. And after that workshop, Lynn kind of grabbed my arm and pulled me aside and said, "Who are you? We should chat." And wound up getting invited to this writers group that they ran, where I wrote this musical Ordinary Days that sort of kickstarted my professional career as a musical theater writer. So that's sort of how it began.
Yeah. And we're gonna get back to that high school. And the,
yes.
The, because as we are going to discover, All the World's a Stage is set in high school, mm-hmm. And all about it takes and is kind of focused on the whole school environment. But talk a little bit about, I mentioned a little bit a few minutes ago about you having commissioned works. And I want to kind of inform the listeners about, because I think they hear that often about people receive commissions from theater companies. Mm-hmm. Explain what that process is like, not only with Keene Company, but other theaters as well, as to what the process is when you are commissioned to do something. Whether it's theater companies put out the word that, you know, they want to commission works, and how do they send out, you know, we have certain themes or topics we want works about, or is it, which I know in this case with Keene Company, you go in and pitch some ideas to them, mm-hmm. About musicals you want to potentially have them produce. So explain how that process works and then go into specifics about how this particular musical landed at Keene Company.
Yeah, I think like many things in all kinds of professions, these commissions most often come out of relationships with people, mm-hmm. at these theaters and at these institutions. I think a big part of my initially getting my work out there was being part of the cabaret and concert scene here in New York, just joining forces with other writers and other performers to do our songs at venues like Joe's Pub and 54 Below and those kind of spaces, which allowed people who worked at these theaters to get to know that I existed, first of all, mm-hmm. and then to start a conversation about, you know, the kinds of things I was interested in writing and that sort of thing. So for me, most often these commissions came out of a relationship that I had at these theaters, and then very similar to the Keene commission, them saying, "Hey, we really like your voice as a writer. Are there ideas that you have for a musical? Can you pitch us, you know, say three ideas, and we'll see which one we respond to the most, and that's the one we'll move forward with." And that was indeed the case with Keene Company. I had been introduced to Keene through the Roundabout, because Roundabout was the theater that produced this first show, Ordinary Days. And a number of people on the board at Roundabout were also on the board of Keene Company. And so they said to Keene Company, "Hey, you've got to meet this guy, Adam, because the mission of Keene Company is to produce intimate works." Mm-hmm. And their artistic director at the time, he just left, Johnny Silverstein. When he joined Keene Company, he wanted to augment that mission of producing intimate plays by also producing intimate musicals. And Ordinary Days is a four-character musical. And so these board members said, "Hey, you got to meet this guy, Adam, who's writing intimate musicals." And Johnny's long-term vision, this is probably 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and Johnny's long-term vision was to be able to have Keene Company commission a brand new intimate musical, because he was programming these intimate musicals. He did shows like John and Jen and Marry Me a Little, Tick, Tick, Boom. And he, as he was searching for more of these musicals to produce, he was finding it more and more difficult to find titles that fit into the mission of what Keene was trying to do. Mm-hmm. So it took him a few years to kind of lay the groundwork and have the company be able to commit to commissioning a show, because commissioning and developing a musical takes a lot of time and resources, right. Which is something that people might not know. And so during the pandemic, I got the call from Johnny saying, "Hey, I think we are ready to green light a commission. what would you like to write about? And that's when I started thinking. We were, as I said, we were in the middle of the pandemic. Theater was shut down at the time. And what that had really got me thinking about was my origin story with theater, separate from, you know, the professional pursuits and the showbiz of it all, which was shut down during the pandemic. I still felt this very deep personal connection and personal relationship to the art form. And that to me was very much connected to my teachers in high school, because they were the ones that forged that connection, that showed me that I could learn about myself and see myself and explore what it meant to be human by reading and performing in plays and musicals. So that was very much on my mind. And at the same moment, you may remember, there were all kinds of conversations happening in the news, specifically about gay and lesbian teachers, and, you know, legislation happening about what gay and lesbian teachers could talk about in the classroom, what kind of materials they could teach. And so that idea, combined with the idea of me thinking about my own teachers in high school, got me thinking, oh my gosh, I bet some of my teachers in high school were gay and I just didn't know it because it wasn't something that was ever talked about. And I started wondering, what would it have been like as a teenager to know that one of my teachers was gay? Would it have been would it have made life easier? Would it have made life more complicated? And that question is sort of what got the story of All the World's a Stage rolling in my head.
It's a delicate equation, solving for unknowns, working with the details I can see. The local alma mater, the family photo, check. The little cross that's dangling from the chain around her neck. Some daily affirmations, a hidden stash of candy bars. The room's a constellation, and I make a picture connecting the stars. If I can put the pieces together, see what I find. If I can put the pieces together, I won't be flying blind. It takes careful observation, a survey of the land, feeling out a map of the terrain. Catch the vibe in every classroom, the gossip in the halls, what books are on the bookshelves and which posters on the walls. Just bits of information, what people show you is all you've got. And like a constellation, there is a story connecting each dot. If I can put the pieces together, see what I find. If I can put the pieces together, here, smiling back as the kids say hey, caring too deeply, charming the pants off the PTA, meeting the spouses, learning their names, pretending I follow football games, walking that tightrope, ready, set, go. that guy. Watch me be that guy.
Give the listeners a little bit of a synopsis of the show without giving too much away, but give it a little bit of a synopsis of the show and the characters, because it is an intimate musical, which is perfect. And, you know, like you said, a perfect fit for Keen Company. And also, I think a perfect fit for the story of the show, because it's a story that is, it's a very intimate personal story with a message. And sometimes sometimes when you try to deliver this kind of message and you want the audience to think, you can sometimes, it can get lost if you have too big of a show.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And you don't want to, you because when you have a bigger show with a bigger cast, you often are required to have multiple subplots going on.
Yeah.
lots of different character arcs going on. And then your message gets kind of lost in the shuffle of all the different things you have to juggle when you have so many things going on.
Yeah.
But with an intimate show like this, you can really focus on what you need to focus on. So talk a little bit about what the show is about and who the characters are.
No, I feel that really to be true. So this is, there are four actors in the show. Mm-hmm. And it takes place in 1996 in a small rural town in Pennsylvania. And the main character is a guy named Ricky, who is a math teacher at this high school in a pretty conservative kind of religious town, which is very much inspired by the place where my partner grew up. And he is approached by a kind of loner misfit student at the school, a girl named Sam, who had seen him at a play at the local community theater. And because of that, she begs him to help her to coach her for a scholarship competition, a monologue competition that would get her a scholarship to study theater in college. And he reluctantly agrees because he is a little hesitant to rock the boat and sort of color outside of the lines at this school where he's trying to play a very particular role in order to fit into the community and kind of keep his job. And this student is a little bit rebellious and winds up performing a monologue from Angels in America for this scholarship competition, which gets Ricky into a bit of hot water in this conservative community, and the walls that he's kind of built up carefully for his life at the school and outside of the school start to crumble. And he has really got to reckon with who he wants to be in the world, and specifically who he has to be in order to help Sam kind of get the future that she needs and deserves. So that's all the world's a stage in a nutshell.
We're meeting for the first time. What do you want me to know about you?
I don't know.
Come on, it's not that complicated.
Not complicated? I'm 17.
Enlighten me.
Monday, I am Juliet, shouting off her balcony, and no one's listening. As teenage girl as you can get, long just to run away. But Tuesday, I am Tybalt, full of confidence and rage, cutting down. All the good parts are the guys. Oh, I don't want to be typecast as the sad girl or whatever they expect from me. There's so much more to who I want to be than what they see.
Of course, you contain multitudes, but people can only know what you choose to show them. Am I right?
People have no imagination. They put us into boxes, or they sort us on a list. If I don't fit in their boxes, do I even still exist? I know here I'm invisible, but out there, there is some place I can be, where I'll be seen.
My dad can't afford college. And there, they don't make sex jokes at the word thespian. I don't want to be typecast as some lone wolf just 'cause no one here is cool with me. And you're here now like this all was meant to be.
I'll think about it.
Thank you!
I said I'd think about it.
Yes, you think about it. You think about it with your big, beautiful math teacher brain.
I don't want to be typecast in the same part I've rehearsed into infinity. And I'm here now like this all was meant to be. Like this all was meant to be.
And talk about setting it in 1996. And what about, you know, what about that specific time period drew you to it? Was it, you know, the political environment, you know, specific events? I mean, there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
To set it in that specific time period.
Yeah, I think there were two things. One is that in 1996, I was the same age as the character of Sam. That was my, those were my high school years. So I feel like I know what it feels like to be a teenager like Sam in high school in 1996. And also, you know, it was this era of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which immediately came to my mind when all of these conversations started happening in 2021 about teachers and their identities. I was like, oh my gosh, we've been here before. We've tried this already. Haven't we learned some lessons from what happened before? And so it seemed to me that there was a real kind of overlap between what was going on in the conversations about queer folks back in the 90s that were resurfacing today. And so it just made a lot of sense to me for both of those reasons to tell this story set in 1996.
Right. And especially for, I mean, I think for younger audiences seeing the show and seeing that it is set in the mid 1990s, and they were not alive in the mid 1990s, so it's basically kind of sending the message to them, you know, what you are going through is history repeating itself. I mean, we've been through this and we've gotten through and we got through it back in the 90s and
exactly.
we can get through it and past it again.
There is something that I find both unsettling but also deeply comforting about this like history repeating idea, that exactly what you said, that we have faced this problem before and we have found a way out of it. There's something that kind of soothes my soul when I hear about historical things that feel like the exact same thing that we're going through in the moment. So yeah, I think part of it for me personally is that balm of we've figured this out before. We can do it again.
Yeah, I mean, I think the journeys of the main characters, Sam and Ricky, sort of can speak really to today's audiences in the really rough, you know, political and social climate we're in right now. Because their memories of the past, I mean, their memories of the past were older audiences who did live through this, but they're also, you know, beacons of hope for younger audiences who maybe feel a little hopeless in these moments, to say, look, you know, here's a flashback from the past to show you that it is not hopeless.
Yeah.
And having someone who stands up for you or someone who gives you guidance, you can help each other. And it's also helping one another get through things, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
I've gotten looks, I've gotten worse. This fabulous face is a gift and a curse. I beat myself up wondering why people sneer. I finally learned that it's nothing in here. People will force you to hide who you are, but don't let them. They're only frightened to meet you because they've never met themselves. And you are a mirror. You are a sparkling star, letting your light shine bright, showing them who they are. You are a mirror. Reflect what is true. They come face to face with themselves just by looking at you. I've been right there, I've been around. Sometimes your tribe is nowhere to be found. It's lonely as hell, searching high, searching low. Stuck on the outside wherever you go. People will tell you you're all by yourself, but don't listen. Out there is someone who knows you and needs you to shine, shine, shine. 'Cause you are a mirror. So you gonna be, baby girl?
I'm snotting all over your books.
You snotted, you bought it.
This is too much. I shouldn't have come.
You came here looking for something, right?
You are a mirror. With myself when I look at you.
So also, and also I want you to talk a little bit about the Dee Dee character played by Elizabeth Stanley in the show.
Yeah, Dee Dee is the school secretary at this high school and someone who forms a friendship with Ricky, someone who seems to be an ally for Ricky at the school, but who is also a part of the evangelical community that exists in this town. And this character, it is very much inspired by my partner's family, who sort of come from that world and who we love. And also there's a sort of complicated layer of all that sort of threaded through our relationships. And I think the thing that I was really trying to capture through that character is someone who earnestly and desperately wants to reach across a divide, an ideological divide, but just doesn't know how and has the best of intentions to try and figure it out. But hasn't been able to figure it out yet. And what's been fascinating to me as this show has been presented in the public is I can feel the audiences really connect to this idea, this question of how do we how do we build these bridges? How do we have these conversations? I think all of the characters in this show, in their own way and to their own varying degrees of success and failure, are trying to bridge these gaps, trying to, for lack of a better word, reach across the aisle. And there's something in the zeitgeist, like I feel audiences desperately seeking answers to that question. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about watching these four characters try to model different ways of having a conversation with someone who you might not understand, and trying to have friendships and genuine feelings for people who there are parts of whom you don't understand. In a surprising way, when I first, you know, saw audiences respond to the show, that seems to be like a really, really resonant idea in the world right now, that people sort of grabbed onto, I think, with the show, and in particular with this Dee Dee character. I think even certainly there are people who come from that kind of religious background that I think really connected to that character and the struggle of that character. Mm-hmm. But I think it even transcended that specific religious idea with just people who in their own ways were forced to question a belief that they grew up with, or question an assumption that they had about a certain group of people or a person that they cared about. I think it's something that a lot of us go through in one way or another.
Does he make you breakfast Sunday mornings? Are you wide awake or sleeping in? You conceal this life with him beside you. I can't help but stand here wondering. Demons, ones you could forgive. could you bear to take my love in pieces? I can't grasp this other life you
And I think it's also benefiting from the fact that it is an intimate show, is that you don't take the easy way out and just make Dee Dee a one-dimensional villain.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You have the space to give Dee Dee multiple dimensions and room for growth as a person, as a character, that, like you said, you give the chance for an audience member to find someone who maybe they align with in some ways, and allows the audience member to grow along with her. So because that's one of the things when I go see a show or I'm watching a film, if there's not at least some main character that I can be in some sort of alignment or empathy with, I have a really hard time enjoying the experience, you know? So if I go to a film and I can't stand any of the characters, it's just a tedious experience when none of them have any redeeming qualities, you know? And so I want to take a journey with someone in the show. And if Dee Dee is the person that some of your audience members can latch on to, you're able to go on the journey, the growth journey with her, and follow the arc. And hopefully the audience gets that, right?
Yeah. I love that you connected to that part of Dee Dee's story, because, like I said, her character is very much inspired by my partner's family. And I feel like we have gone on that journey with them as evidence of what's possible. I mean, they kind of went from, you know, sending my partner to conversion therapy programs when he was a teenager to now sending us matching pajama sets for Christmas, you know, which to me is such it took a long time, but the idea that kind of change and ability to open oneself up to something new is possible was important for me to capture in the story. Even if Dee Dee doesn't quite get there by the end, I wanted the audience to really feel like it's possible. It takes time, but it's possible.
Right. And I also, even though I know that this isn't the main focus of the show, I do like the fact that one of the main driving forces of the show is Sam's determination to win the thespian contest, so that she can get a scholarship somewhere, because that's one of the other issues I think that has become so troubling here in the U.S. is the underfunding and lack of funding in arts education. Mm-hmm. It, to me, you having gone to an arts magnet school, how beneficial I think that was for you, even if you didn't realize it at the time. I mean, you are, you know, a kind of an exemplary example of what that produces when you have art focus in education. And I think even though it's not a main message of the show, it is an important message, right? I mean, because arts education, especially theater, because I grew up doing theater as a kid, and it totally changed my life.
Yeah.
It gave me whole different avenues to pursue, not even inside the arts. It just gave me so much training and self-confidence and presentational skills and things that have helped me in other areas outside of theater. I like the fact that that's kind of a plot device here that I hope people also take away.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think one thing that you mentioned that I felt like I took for granted going to this arts high school that now when I look back on it, realize was so special was because the school had just opened when I started going there, and because it was a public school, the school attracted all of these teachers from the public school system who loved the arts, even if they weren't teaching the arts, mm-hmm. which I think is why this idea of a math teacher who loved theater became the main character of the show, because at my high school, the teacher who was teaching math loved Sondheim, and the teacher who mm-hmm. was teaching physics, loved music. Like there was just this deep appreciation for the arts for everyone in that building. And looking back on that, I find it to be incredibly moving to see that the arts are such a meaningful part of people's lives, even if you don't choose to pursue it professionally, that these works of art, these shows, these musicals, really have the ability to touch and transform someone in like a really personal, really human way that I think we in the sort of theater bubble often mm-hmm. often forget, but that's really why we do the thing we do, is to put a piece of ourselves out there that can hopefully bring comfort or a moment of identification to someone out there who's listening.
If you could see the part of me that hates that dress as much as you do, who likes it when you're loud and standing tall, if you could see the part of me who'd give you thunderous ovations for performing Tony Kushner in the hall, if you could see the part of me who looks at you and sees this fearless kid I never got to be. You never faced the world alone if you could see that part of me. If you could see the part of me I grew up thinking was impossible, a life, a home, a man I've come to love. If you could see the part of me wants to share the joy I've stumbled on and knows it's something I am worthy of. If you could see the part of me I push aside because the only choice I've got is safe or free. I'd never face the world alone if you could see that part of me. Cost of hiding, that's the price to pay. Love becomes a weapon, love gets turned to shame, love becomes a secret too dangerous to name. I become a weapon, I fill up with shame, but it's the world splits us into pieces. You are not broken. You are not broken. It's the world that splits us into pieces. We are not broken.
Are you hoping that on two, this is kind of a two-layered question, because I know you had firsthand experience to hear what audiences took away from seeing the show. And talk about that a little bit. What was the feedback from audiences when they saw the show? But also when people listened to the cast recording, which is now out, as I mentioned, from Joy Machine Records. And the other thing that's great about the cast recording is that there's plenty of dialogue and plot and character stuff on the cast recording. So you will be able to follow along and figure out what's going on in the show.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, when you listen to the cast recording. So there's kind of two different things, because one, you've already heard the feedback from people who've seen the show, but people listening to the cast recording, what are you hoping people are going to get from this experience?
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that the story comes across on the album, because I worked very diligently to try and figure out what to include on the album so that people could have some kind of total experience of the story, even if they hadn't seen the production or quite honestly aren't familiar with the story at all. Because you know, we had a relatively limited off-Broadway run. And so I imagine most people who encounter the album will not have seen the show, actually. So it was important for me to give the album a sense of the whole thing. So there's a bunch of dialogue included. The actors are just incredible in the way that they translated the performances that they had in the theater onto the album. So I'm excited for folks to hear that. And I think the thing that was most striking to me in experiencing the show with an audience was all the different ways in that people found through these four different characters. It just seemed like anyone who saw the show had some kind of person in their life who was one of these four people. And the most moving thing to me was every time the curtain came down, I'd be sort of watching from the back of the house, as I want to do. And strangers would come rushing up to me and just sort of spilling their life stories out to me, stories about teachers that they had that shaped their life, stories about, repairing relationships with estranged family members because of their sexuality, just like all kinds of personal stories that I found so moving, because I felt like the only way I could share my personal story with the world was to fictionalize it and put it in the mouths of these like fake people on stage. And it was so moving to me that somehow the act of doing that allowed people so openly, who I had never met before, to share a piece of themselves and to say, I am so touched and grateful that I saw a part of my story on stage through this show. So I really just hope that idea continues, and that people in all kinds of communities are able to see themselves in these four characters. And like I said, hopefully foster that kind of conversation, allow people to sort of open up and be themselves in a way that they maybe wouldn't be able to otherwise.
So now that the show has had a successful off-Broadway run and the cast recording is now out, is it available for licensing yet? What's the next stages for this? Is it another production coming, or is it now going to be available for regional theaters? What's next?
Yeah, it will be available for licensing very soon. I think it will start to pop up in some regional theaters starting next season.
Good.
There's always talk about trying to find a way to extend the life of the show in New York. Mm. I don't know whether or not that will happen, to be perfectly honest. And part of the impetus for the Kean Company commission for this intimate musical was the idea that we could create a musical at a scale with four actors in a pretty small band that smaller theaters could do, who are interested in putting on a musical that might not have the resources to do a big cast splashy kind of musical. So even while those conversations about further life in New York are happening, it was really important to me that we let the theaters across the country who want to do the show, which is not always the case when these conversations are happening. So I'm really thrilled that the licensing is going to be available and that this can be done by the communities that I always hoped would be able to do it.
Yeah, it's a perfect show for regional theaters. And it's an important show, you know. And I think,
thank you.
And also getting back to, you know, what people take away from the show. A lot of that, I know that you're being somewhat modest, a lot of that is due to your skill as a composer lyricist.
Thank you.
And you're writing, because you are, and as a lot of people have said in the past, you're writing your song, especially your songwriting, is so wonderful at capturing character and emotion, and it gets across the message you need to get across. So that's a very rare skill with a songwriter.
And I think I really appreciate that.
You know, and that's kind of the reputation that Adam has, so the listeners know, is that he's, and that's why Lynn Ahrens pulled you aside. I know.
She is the master at character and emotion.
Yes. So what else now that this baby has been birthed, so to speak, and is out there, what is next up for you, if you care to share?
Yeah, I'm spending most of my time right now finishing up the first draft of a new musical that is a commission from Roundabout back at my artistic home at the Roundabout. Mm-hmm. I'm writing this one with a collaborator, actually the same collaborator that I wrote Scotland PA with, wonderful playwright named Michael Mitnick. Mm-hmm. And we're working on an original show this time. And I'd say we're about 3/4 of the way to having a complete first draft. So it's my hope that in the next couple months we'll be able to turn something into Roundabout and see what they think, and maybe do a reading of it and see where it takes us.
Oh, terrific. That's great. Well, yeah. You're very prolific, I only rattled off a few of your musicals. you are a very prolific, wonderful songwriter. So again, congratulations on All the World's a Stage.
Thank you.
As I said, the Off-Broadway cast recording is available from Joy Machine Records, and it is a definite wonderful to get your hands on. And my listeners are going to get sick of hearing me say this, but I always say it. Two things I always say. One, first off, you can stream it if you want, but the preference is that you purchase the download, because streaming does not put anything but mere pennies into anyone's pocket. So you need to purchase a download, because that helps to finance more cast recordings from these record labels and puts more money into people's pockets, like Adam's pocket. So you need to purchase a download. They're not that expensive. They're less expensive than buying a physical CD, so you can purchase a download. The other thing I tell people is you need to dedicate the time, and you can find the time in your day to sit down and listen to a cast recording from beginning to end in one sitting. Put your headphones on, your earbuds in, and listen to it from beginning to end, all in one sitting, because it's, especially with a cast recording, it's all about a story, and it's taking you on a character's journey. It's taking you on a plot journey. There's an arc you're needing to follow, and the songwriters and librettists are taking you on a voyage, a musical voyage that you need to listen to from beginning to end. I know people want to go in and sample songs and pull out songs, and I know on this show you're going to hear samples of songs, but you need to listen to it from beginning to end. That's the best experience. If you can't see the show in person, listen from beginning to end in one sitting. Maybe take a break if there's an intermission, maybe. but my preference is beginning to end. I even say that for vocalist albums too, because vocalist albums, you know, they sequence them for a reason. So
yeah, a lot of thought goes into putting the order together. That's right.
And I always tell that for vocalist albums too. You have the time in your day to do it. It's your time to sit down and listen to music and do it that. Anyway, my lecture is over.
Wise words.
They hear this every time from me, and they roll their eyes, but I say it all the time. Anyway, Adam, I'm thrilled that you are on the show. And I would love to have you back sometime soon. So
oh, I love that.
We will chat offline about that. But people, where can people find you? Where's the best place to send people to get the album and to get more information about you?
Yeah. If you go to my website, adamguan.com, there are links to all of the things. I'm also on Instagram, if you like that sort of thing. And I put links and videos and posts there as well. So yeah, those are the two spots.
Great. Well, I will put a link to your website on the radio show page so people can find you. Again, much congratulations to All the Worlds of Stage and your work. We will hopefully have you back soon.
Thank you so much.
My mother left because she followed her psychic to Portland. I am serious. When I was just a kid, she had this woman who saw all the lives that my mother was channeling. This woman said, "Follow me." She did. Now she's living other lives, changing her address like she's just changing clothes. All of these my mother told me about all the souls she was channeling. One was a fisherman, one was a mountaineer. She thought her French was so good because she used to plow fields in the Pyrenees. At least she's original, that's clear. She's got these eyes. My mom, I was gonna try out for that scholarship. She said, "Are you serious?" I didn't want to fight. She told me actresses sparkle and shimmer and have to be beautiful. That I'm almost beautiful, but not quite. She's got these eyes.